Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, folks. Welcome to the newest session of Entrepreneurship and Globalization. We're going to be talking tonight about population and resources. We're shifting a little bit in terms of the mode of the course. We started out up to last week with a number of sessions that were intended to offer some tools, insights, ways of thinking about how to frame and launch a new venture. So I hope that you guys got some good value out of the discussion of lean startup approaches and the discussion with Mark Nager last week. I'm really pleased he could join us. And so what I want to do this week and coming up is to talk about a little bit about how the process of globalization is creating opportunities and also creating obstacles in terms of framing entrepreneurial ventures. So for today and also in the podcast that you had for last Monday, it's really about global trends and how to think about it in terms of your own entrepreneurial visions. So it's really this kind of micro to really macro view. The premise here is that we don't make the most of where we are in a particular historical moment if we don't understand what that moment is. And tonight's conversation is really about the stories that might make people doubt whether or not we really are facing an era of increased prosperity. So I want to start right in with a piece from The Guardian that I just tweeted to the Ashoka Yu hashtag a few minutes ago. If you're not at your computer and haven't pulled that up, that's not a problem. I'll read out the sections of the piece that I think are most relevant. But I think what this piece does is it helps to illustrate that the narrative of population pressure leading to resource scarcity, leading to conflict, is one that is really very much alive and well. And I'm going to talk in a moment a little bit more about its origins. But when we think about the concerns over the next 20, 30, 40 years, a lot of them have to do with the issue of population and people as consumers and the pressures on resources that growing populations create. So let me read from this Guardian piece. Now, the piece is about Gambisa Moyo's new book. She's been very prolific in the last couple of years, and her first book, Dead Aid, was a critique of that came out, I guess, in 2009. Was a rather biting critique of international development industry and essentially the lack of beneficial outcomes that we've seen from sort of 50 years plus of development assistance. Now, I mean, again, you can sort of refer to her book for her story on this. I talk a little bit about aid in Becoming Prosperity. I don't focus on it because I don't think that that's really that big a story in the larger frame of changes happening in the world. But this book, Winner Take All, that she just finished is about resource scarcity. So she starts out really in very much the same way that I start out Becoming Prosperity, by emphasizing the tremendous growth in global prosperity that we're expecting to see in the next 20 years. So she says, put another way, in less than 20 years, we will witness the creation of a middle class of roughly the same size as the current total population of Africa, North Africa, and Europe. And then the Guardian then sort of chimes in the reporter summarizing argument, naturally they will want mobile phones, fridges, cars, and washing machines. 2,000 new cars already joined Beijing streets every day. In 2010, China had 40 cities with population of more than a million. By 2020, it plans to have added another 225 cities with more than a million people. The implications for the world's commodity resources are stark and sobering. Global demand for food and water is expected to increase by 50% and 30% respectively by 2030. The pressure on copper, lead, zinc, and corn is already becoming unsustainable, and no one has a clue where the energy we'll need is going to come from. So the sort of punchline of the book is that the only people who seem to have this figured out are the Chinese, who are going on a global commodity buying spree and are essentially seeking to insure themselves from future price increases, if not to be dominant players dictating market prices. So that's, you know, this story of the way in which growth in population creates resource scarcity, which then drives up prices and eventually leads to societal collapse of some type or another. And the headline for this Guardian article is, "The world will be drawn into a war for resources." And that's the headline. So, you know, not as rosy a picture, it would seem, of the next 20, 30, 40 years as the one that I appear to be conveying in The Coming Prosperity, and yet from, you know, very similar premises. Now, you know, first of all, before I kind of get into, you know, my take on the general themes that that Moyo is writing about, let me just sort of connect this back to why I think this matters for entrepreneurial ventures. And I want to just allude for, you know, a couple of minutes to the trip I just took to Ecuador last week. So the primary purpose in going to Ecuador, as you probably saw from my tweets, was to visit my friend who works down there, Douglas McMeekin. Douglas founded the Achana Foundation about 20 years ago. And essentially what Achana is about is creating different approaches to provide people, particularly young people, in the Ecuadorian Amazon with education and also job opportunities in the various ventures that Douglas has created, primarily the Achana Lodge, at the same time that it helps with the objective of advancing this is sort of the conservation and sustainability in the Ecuador and Amazon. Now, Douglas's operation is very small, obviously, relative to the scope of the territory, and the number of people that have gone through his school is not huge. The populations of indigenous people in the regions that we're talking about also aren't huge. So, you know, this isn't a program that's reaching tens of thousands of people. But, you know, as we all know, the Amazon, particularly the Ecuadorian Amazon or Ecuador in general, is a place really exceptionally rich with biodiversity. And so the aim of trying to balance human and environmental objectives is fairly stark. Now, why do I get into all this when we were just talking about global population growth and resource scarcity? Well, you know, the point is that the Ecuadorian Amazon and sort of frontier places are really a kind of a microcosm of what we see on a global scale. Now, you know, on one hand, we can look at the indigenous populations of the Amazon as a cause of the problem, or even, you know, as victims in the sense that, you know, maybe it's oil companies coming in and taking advantage of the indigenous people's lack of understanding of their rights, their property rights, or else the failure to negotiate adequately that leads to exploitation of resources, particularly oil resources, and so you see a degradation of the environment that comes about as a consequence of development. Up in Quito, we see a different problem, where as a consequence of climate change, there's some real concern that the glaciers and the the high altitude aquifers that have been supplying Quito, you know, which as you guys probably know is at about 2,500 meters in elevation, if I remember correctly, you know, is a city that is highly vulnerable to water scarcity issues. And so to the extent that those aquifers and those glaciers don't prove sustainable as a consequence of climate change, then the city of Quito would be really imperiled. And I start with these examples because I think that these are ones I'm very concerned about personally. I mean, that's why I think the work that Douglas is doing is so important. And, you know, when we think about places where, like the places that Moyo is writing about, that have resource wealth, but are environmentally sensitive, or as Quito is as a city, vulnerable to disruptions, and there are other parts of the world that are vulnerable in different ways to changes in the environment. You know, we have to be really concerned about that. So all of that is by way of underscoring and reiterating the narrative of concern. So why should we feel that there is some promise and even opportunity in this process, the seemingly inexorable process of the growth of human population? Well, let's take this story back, the story that Moyo is telling. Let's take it back to its origin. And so one of your assigned readings for tonight was Thomas Malthus on an essay on the principle of population. And I expect that most of you were well familiar with this particular book before you signed up for this course. If you were like me, I had not carefully studied Malthus until I started writing Becoming Prosperity. It was something I sort of zipped through as an undergraduate, and it's always been sort of in the background. But I never really could take a careful look at it. And it's an extraordinarily well argued book. And the premise of the book is pretty straightforward, that there's a sort of inevitable process that happens in human populations. And it begins, let's say, when times are good. So when times are good in a certain environment, people are able to have more children, populations grow, and times continue to be good until the population reaches a point that the community runs into a wall of resource scarcity, and conflict ensues, or potentially a plague or pestilence or some other societal calamity that then leads to a population collapse. And we see the, you know, similar phenomenon in non-human populations and these sort of cycles, ecological cycles. So Malthus's story was actually a great story. It described with a fairly high level of accuracy almost the entirety of human history up to the point when Malthus wrote his book. So this is a book that was published in 1796, so basically until that point. Through all the span of history that Malthus was able to observe, something like the argument that he advanced held. But what changed at the end of the 18th century? Two things changed. One is that population took off, and so you had this sort of exponential growth in human populations that I talk about in Becoming Prosperity. We've got, you know, two extremely simple graphs there that come out of data from Angus Madison that he compiled, the more unique data that Madison compiled, and the references are all in the book, was for a different thing that started taking off at the end of the 18th century, and that was per capita income. Now, you know, we can have a conversation, and I definitely welcome questions about this. We had a little bit of a discussion about this topic when Umair Haque was on, about the extent to which per capita income is a accurate or legitimate measure of human well-being. But, you know, folks who kind of look at this pretty seriously and look at the correlation of per capita income with other indicators of human well-being, whether it's health or schooling or child mortality, which is within the health category, obviously, you know, that up to about $10,000 per year, it appears as though per capita income really is a pretty good proxy for other dimensions of human welfare. So if we take that as a reasonable kind of proxy, and we look at per capita income globally going back to about the end of the 18th century, you see that just as population starts to take off, global well-being takes off on at also an exponential rate. So what happened is when people really began to be connected and the tools of productivity began to be widely available, at least in the richest sixth of the world, you had this really dramatic increase in human welfare. Now, on one hand, this really has been a global phenomenon, and so you'll have seen the Hans Rosling video, and I think that's just a brilliant piece of work. I mean, in 4 minutes, I'm not going to, you know, even attempt to summarize the whole reason, you know, point of assigning it. But I mean, anybody who's on this call who didn't tune into that that video that was assigned for tonight, you absolutely must see it, not just for this course, but just because it's entertaining and hugely edifying. And what Rosling points out is that, you know, in the 1830s, the entire planet was essentially the way we think about the poorest parts of the world now, whether it's Afghanistan or Sub-Saharan Africa or the poorest parts of South Africa, South America, wherever you want to look. You know, that was the state of basically the entire world in 1830, and then there was an interval where the rich sixth of the world, sort of in terms of health outcomes. And Rosling's piece doesn't talk about per capita income as much, but, you know, really kind of launched ahead. And in the last 30 or 40 years, we've seen this remarkable improvement in human well-being elsewhere in the world. So one of the things that is really key to the story that Rosling is telling is the sort of number one reason that Malthus turned out to be wrong, and that's the demographic transition. That is, people, as societies get wealthier, people tend to have fewer children. And you know, that this is something that would have been impossible for Malthus to understand or predict, but it turns out to be a very sort of constant phenomenon across societies. And in fact, you know, there's only a few countries in the world, particularly large countries, Nigeria being one, that have yet to experience the demographic transition. But these are the exceptions on a global scale, not the rule. And as I point out in the book, I mean, this is a phenomenon that's so striking that in Hong Kong, which, you know, as you all know, was a British colony until about 14 years ago. And so it was not, is not, and was not subjected to China's one-child policy, but is and has been more prosperous than certainly the average in mainland China, and today even than, you know, most of the wealthier cities in China. Hong Kong has a lower birth rate than the rest of China. So in other words, a place that hasn't been subjected to the one-child policy, but it has been essentially subject to this demographic transition that I'm talking about, has a lower birth rate than mainland China, where people have been subjected to the one-child policy now for decades. Likewise, Sri Lanka, you know, which is a country that had sort of comparable initial state of development to China, no draconian population measures, and yet a fertility rate that's comparable to China. So that's the number one reason that we see that Malthus was wrong. But, you know, there's another question, and it has to do with resource scarcity. So this gets back to the argument that Moyo is making, and that, you know, goes back to an update that we saw to this in the Club of Rome, the Club of Rome's famed Limits to Growth report that came out in the late 1970s. And, you know, I talk in the book about the population bomb, the Ehrlich's Road. And so there was a whole, you know, sequence of pieces that were essentially extrapolated from current trends into the future, predicted nightmare scenarios of different types. Now, I have to be a little careful here because, you know, I'm drawing, you know, upwardly sloping curves in per capita income and population, and essentially doing the same thing that I'm claiming the limits to growth people did or Dambisa Moyo is doing, and that's sort of just projecting out from current trends as if nothing will alter them. I think it's, again, as a consequence of the demographic transition, you know, there's a general consensus that world population will not continue to grow exponentially. In fact, it's already beginning to slow in the richer countries. The concern now is newly about depopulation, about the fertility rates that are too low, about aging populations, true even in China, but certainly true in the United States and Japan. It's a serious issue. And so the nature of the concern has actually shifted 180 degrees within 20 years in the rich countries from being one about overpopulation to being around being a concern about depopulation. So on one hand, you know, we have this notion that these curves that I'm talking about, population curves, will flatten out. But on the resource scarcity side, the one element, and this is really the core piece that I want you to take away from this, and I think the one that has the most relevance to sort of thinking about your own ventures that you know, keep these global trends in mind. And you know, I'll be looking. Michael and I will be tracking your Twitter questions and ready to take calls and questions, you know, on the phone as well in just a couple minutes. But the main element to keep in mind in terms of the resource issue is simply prices. Prices are the manner in which the bad thing of resource scarcity becomes the good thing of inducing innovation. Okay. If we don't have prices and we simply have quotas, then the type of nightmare scenario that Moyo is talking about would seem quite plausible. If there was a certain amount of nickel in a fixed world, and you could only use nickel to produce the things that use nickel today, or lead, or iron ore, or wood, or whatever it happens to be. But let's focus on the non-renewable, so leave wood out of it for a minute. If people were not allowed to innovate, and if everything had to be consumed in exactly the same proportions that it's always that they are consumed, let's say, today, then something pretty much exactly like the scenario that Moyo is painting would be almost certain to play itself out. But we know that that's not the world that we live in. You know, if somebody in the 1850s had sought to corner the market for energy by buying all of the whaling rights in all of the seven seas, that would not have been a very effective way to corner the market for energy, because we had a new thing that came along, petroleum. I mean, petroleum was the one thing that allowed some whales to survive. And as maligned, and I think rightly so, as the oil industry is today, you know, it was a conservation program from the standpoint of the conservation of whales that has not been matched since. The point is that prices and scarcity induce alternatives. So if you're interested in the sort of alternatives that might be induced by higher prices, you would be well advised to take a look at a book that's very synchronous in its themes to the coming prosperity, but much more focused on technology, new technology options, and that's Abundance by Peter Diamandis. And Abundance, you know, has a sort of picture and image of tinfoil, I'm sorry, of aluminum foil on its cover, and you know, it's just the first few pages of the book. I won't give it away too much, but it's an entertaining anecdote about how, you know, essentially, you know, 300 years ago, aluminum was prized above platinum and gold. It was the absolute rarest, most sought after most advanced, most most extravagant material in the world. And now, you know, we use it to wrap our fried chicken. Now, the reason is that there was an inducement to innovation, and there was a way of making better use of the resources that were available that allowed aluminum to be produced. And of course, the techniques of production, the creation of the alloy, all of which was done in a much more efficient way and a larger scale. If we look at the what the history of aluminum, just like the history of the oil industry, that what becomes a new entrant then becomes the incumbent. And what becomes an opportunity for society then becomes an obstacle to be overcome to get to the future. This is the way in which innovation works. As Paul Pollack says, institutions are radical ideas cast in concrete, and the same is true for technology. The fact that a technology that essentially did good, created opportunities, allowed for the expansion of human potential in a different era, is now something that is retrograde and an obstacle to future development, should come as no surprise to anybody. This is the absolute core regularity of human history and the development of new technologies. So without innovation, without entrepreneurship, without the creation of new ways to provide the goods and services of today that demand different other resources than those that we're accustomed to using today, then we can expect that there will be crises in the future. But we've got now these same 3 billion people that Dambisa Moyo is talking about, this new middle class that is globally distributed, that is ready to do what we've been talking all along: connect, contribute, create, collaborate, and be part of the envisioning of new possibilities. Sometimes these are technical possibilities, sometimes these are business possibilities, and sometimes these are just other ways of creating social value that don't seem directly tied to the consumption of resources. So, again, the premises are the same. We are at an epical transition that we are seeing a shift in the nature of social organization, where it's no longer the case that 1/100th or 1/10th or even 1/6 of the world's population comprises the entirety of the knowledge producing potential, that we're now at a point where that is distributed more and more globally, and it's as a consequence of that we can start to that we can have a much more encouraging view about the next 20 or 30 years than is represented in this piece by Dambisa Moyo. So now I'm going to turn to some questions. Kaylee has a great question from Twitter, and so we're going to start to monitor those, and if you want to call in, you can call in to the line, but let me read out Kaylee's question. Will there continue to be space for new developments when there are so few companies controlling the market now? So, this really gets back in a really interesting way to the China question. First of all, Let me take a stab at this question of prices and their effect from a different angle, and then I'm gonna loop back around to Kaylee's question. So I want everyone to think about this really carefully, okay? now you can switch the brand if you want, but I'm gonna pick Lay's potato chips. Okay, so that's a certain brand of potato chips here. okay? So, and let's say that a bag of Lay's potato chips costs $2.99. That's like a normal grocery store-sized bag. And let's say that the government decides that potato chips are bad because they cause obesity. And so they're going to put a tax on potato chips. And they're going to start with Lay's potato chips, okay? So the government's going to put a $100 tax on Lay's potato chips. So now it's going to cost anybody who is buying Lay's potato chips, it's going to now cost them $102.99 for a bag of potato chips. Okay? So what is the cost of that tax to the 2 million, or say to the million people who were buying Lay's potato chips? So it's $3 million of expenditure, roughly, potato chips by the million people who are buying Lay's potato chips for $2.99. What's the cost to them of that tax when the government imposes it? Okay, the answer is zero, because nobody will buy a $100 bag of potato chips. The cost is zero, because consumers will shift to another brand of potato chips. They will never bear that cost, right? Now, I use a tax example to emphasize the point of substitution. When substitutes are available, the ability to control a market or the price increase within a market is not a factor to which consumers are vulnerable. So the issue then all comes around substitution. Now, to the extent that there are current practices that really depend on certain minerals, and there was a whole conversation around certain varieties of scarce minerals that the U.S. has stopped producing because it wasn't economically viable, and now these are used in electronics, and they're overwhelmingly mined in China at great risk to the miners and so forth and so on. So control over a genuinely scarce resource to which there are very few good substitutes can create monopoly power, and it absolutely can lead to a circumstance in which a monopoly can dictate prices. But let's think about the example where this seems to have been borne out the most clearly in oil, right? So there's a lot of talk about OPEC's price manipulation and how OPEC tries to push the price up of oil up and extract the greatest amount of gain from its control over monopoly prices. Well, that story turns out to be totally, completely wrong. OPEC is about 25% of the world oil market. There are substitutes to OPEC oil, which is the production from non-OPEC producers. And furthermore, to the extent that OPEC has been successful in restraining output and driving prices up, there has been a history of OPEC members themselves essentially cheating on their quotas in order to take advantage of the more than normal deviance between the marginal price of production and the price of oil. So even in the case where we think that there's market dominance, as in the OPEC at its height, when we scrutinize it a little bit further, we realize that market power has tended not to be used effectively to raise prices. In fact, just the opposite. OPEC has been for a couple of decades now been very carefully keeping the price of oil low enough so that it wouldn't induce innovation and substitution. The objective of OPEC is not to have the price of oil as high as it can be. It's to have it as high as it can be without inducing serious investment into substitutes. So when we see that oil and coal are consistently just below the thresholds that would induce serious investment into substitutes, that's for a reason. That is actually a tactical move on the part of a monopoly or a cartel, and that is feasible. So the control of resources by a few companies and the extent to which that really creates societal vulnerabilities depends on the availability of substitutes, both in the short term and in the long term. That's what it's all about. And if there are resources that genuinely for which there are genuinely no substitutes in the near term and poor substitutes in the long term, and those are controlled by a single entity or a very solid cartel, you know, that will create vulnerabilities for other people. There's no doubt about it. My only point is that resources like that are extremely rare. In fact, I don't believe that there are many. But again, that depends on on the extent to which we can innovate new substitutes. So, really long answer. I think that we have to really look very seriously at the issue of the availability of substitutes and the genuine evidence of market power, even in places where it looks like there is market dominance to the point of being able to control prices and extract rents from people. So now I'm going to take it back to Michael, see what else we've got lined up for questions. Michael? Just pause for 1 minute while Michael scans the Twitter feed. And if you want to call in, I think everybody has the number. But in any event, it's 347-945-5608. And any question that either relates to, I mean, first and foremost, obviously, to the material that we're covering this week, also last week's material, technology and long run growth, and material in the book, so forth and so on, all that is open. Okay. If global population goes linear, when will resources become scarce? To the extent that something has a stable market price, it's scarce. I think the greatest resource concern globally, certainly the one that I feel is the overriding global priority, is water. The only promising, I think the most promising aspect of water scarcity issues is that we waste so much water and we price it as so close to zero as we do. So although there is certainly every reason to believe that water scarcity is going to be the huge resource scarcity issue of the 21st century, we don't see a lot of evidence of that scarcity yet because we still see zero pricing for water. Now, there's a sense in which, we don't want water to be treated as any other commodity and to be subject to the sort of price increases that I've been referring to because it is, a human necessity. So to some extent, that would seem to argue for an approach in which water was immune to price increases. And I think that's what makes water particularly difficult, because unless we have the sort of signaling through genuine prices, not inflated prices that are due to speculative behavior, and not prices that are a consequence of monopoly power, but prices that express the nature of scarcity and that compel people to use resources in a wise manner, just as we've seen in gas. When it gets over $4 a gallon, people are more careful with that resource, and I think the same is true with water. So the point is we see evidence of scarcity all around. We see the search for substitutes all around. In the case of gasoline, it's not necessarily just another resource, say switching from fossil fuel based gasoline to ethanol or other sources of fuel for transportation. it's not just that type of substitution. It's also just walking rather than using your car, bicycle. That substitution as well. So it's not always technological fixes. Sometimes it's behavioral fixes. So we see the scarcity all the time. We see the role of prices all the time. We tend not to make as much progress when we impede clear price signals as when prices accurately reflect value. And so, you know, those of you who are sort of thinking, well, you know, in terms of fossil fuels, there's so many distortions, and, you know, the prices that we're paying at the pump, in the United States at least, aren't reflective of the true social costs and the true, actual costs of gasoline consumption. I'm not going to disagree with you. But that doesn't change the role of the price mechanism in allocating scarce resources. The other thing that we want to do, well, we've got about 10 minutes left for this sort of segment of the class, and in the final 10 minutes, and we may start this in the next 5 minutes, depending on what questions come through, is a little bit of a recap of where we are in the course, questions about the requirements. What the objective should be in terms of getting to badges, and also what we as the sort of organizers of the course feel are our goals. This is a good question from Nicole. I mean, this is a great question. Where do governments play a role in facilitating innovation? Can they play an active role, or can only crisis induce? A lot of what I've been saying has been focused on the role of crisis. And, you know, this may seem like I realize there's a tremendous danger in this kind of condensed presentation that this seems like some sort of ideological point or something that I want to believe is true, you know, even if it isn't. I actually want to believe the opposite is true. I started the work that I'm doing, as I note in the book, working for John Holden, who is currently President Obama's science advisor. And, you know, that work and the work that I did with Lou Branscombe at the Kennedy School on policies to induce innovation was all about the positive role that government can play in transitioning new technologies to market. And, you know, one of the core elements of the work at the Science, Technology, and Public Policy Program, where I was and had a great experience at the Kennedy School, was to advocate for increased funding for energy R&D. Where I came to the views that I currently hold is simply by observing these changes that we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, for all the talk about changing consumer behavior and bringing new technologies to market as a function of increased research and development spending, where we really saw change begin to happen in the energy system, and again, it's a constant battle between inducement for new exploration and exploitation of fossil fuel sources, as we're seeing with the fracking, you know, and as we're seeing with oil on a global scale, and the inducement of innovations of real substitutes. So it's this race that prices create. But at the same time, what we've seen, if we've seen any movement in the last 30 years on energy policy, it's been overwhelmingly as a consequence of increased prices and not because of increased investment in R&D or policies, possibly excluding policies for the CAFE standards, the efficiency standards for vehicles in the United States, and certainly the great story about energy efficiency requirements in California. So we do have some stories of policy making a big difference, but it's really been prices more than policy that have proven effective. So that's why I tell that story. Is there a positive role? I mean, there absolutely is a generically positive role for the government in de-risking technologies at the early stage and basically making it possible for new technologies to demonstrate their effectiveness in the Small Business Innovation Research Program in the United States, which is the government's oldest program for supporting new technology development. And it's really a contract program, a grants and contracts program, not an investment program. It certainly sometimes characterizes government as the venture capitalist. It's nothing of the sort. It's just simply that agencies have particular needs to have problems solved. Companies bid for that, and then as a consequence of getting that SBIR money, that government money, which you guys and your ventures can be looking for too. It's this low cost in the sense of you know, not you don't have to give up equity. You know, you sign a contract to provide a particular goods and services, whether it's with the government or whether it's with a municipality, it's a federal government, municipality, or a corporation, and you sort of start to have a customer. That's what the SBIR program does to new companies. So that sort of program can be very effective. And I think, again, this sort of bridging, you know, when people talk about the valley of death and early stage technology, can be very important. The government can play a huge role as a buyer of new technologies. I think that there's a tremendous unmet potential in the United States for the federal government, the GSA, that is the buyer of building services. So the federal government has a large share, more than a quarter, well over a quarter of the world's of the buildings in the United States. And so it's a tremendous sort of buying power that the government has, governments at different levels. And so having federal standards that induce innovation, is a role that government can play. But I would say the biggest role, and, you know, this is difficult for an entrepreneur to take the lead in, this is really a more public policy advocacy, is to stop favoring incumbents, to favor existing technologies less, and to push back against all those various sort of subsidies and advantages that accrue over time to incumbents. And so it's the most significant thing that the government can do in terms of inducing innovation is simply to stop giving advantages to incumbents. And, you know, the examples here are, you know, rife across the board, whether we talk about energy infrastructure, healthcare infrastructure, financial services infrastructure, or educational infrastructure for that matter, the way in which current economically dominant entities protect that advantage through the role of government is, I think, really the critical obstacle to innovation. By removing that, or a critical obstacle, and by lessening that, the government can do really remarkable things. Okay, so Danny has a question. The military innovates faster. Should they share their inventions faster? The thing about military innovation is really interesting. The military is in a unique position of being the investor in the basic research all the way to the product. For at least traditionally, that's been the case. It used to be most of the technologies they acquired. Now it's actually a small set because 85% of the technology, and this was, 5 years ago, that the Department of Defense in the United States uses is commercial off-the-shelf technology. So a lot of the technology is not developed within the military. But still, for that 15%, back in the 1960s, the United States Department of Defense in the early 1960s was represented one-third of all research and development spending in the world. And I cite that statistic in the book, but I mean, to repeat that, just the U.S. Department of Defense was responsible for one-third of all R&D globally. So that's a hell of an impact. And those technologies, people always talk about the internet but it's not the only thing, did sort of bridge this early stage process in a way that in a number of cases was faster than one would have seen through a market mechanism, because at every stage the military was responsible. Now, that doesn't mean the military got itself the best deal feasible. That's not the point. This question is about speed. So there's an interesting exchange about the role of governments in de-risking new technologies that I think we can loop in here in a minute. But in any event, yes, I think there is an opportunity to have the government to sort of accelerate spin-offs of technology. There's something the CIA has an entity called Incutel, which is intended actually to invest in companies that can provide technology to the CIA, but it's all the same mechanism can be used to sort of spin out technologies, and I think that there is some real potential here. So now Sandy is disagreeing with me. She's saying that military financing is intimately connected to incumbents. To expect them to innovate is flawed. I mean, you know, she's right. the whole military-industrial complex and, you know, the nature of the closed nature of military contracting at the sort of levels I'm talking about. But we were talking about speed to market, and incumbents can be fast. I mean, you look at a GE or an IBM, I mean, they do have a tradition of innovation, and military innovation is the same. I don't think that entrepreneurs can necessarily say they're faster than incumbents. Beating an incumbent, a powerful incumbent, is not that easy. So Sandy just like does not buy anything I'm saying right now. You should call in, Sandy. You should have called in and disagreed with me. I may be exaggerating the favorables of this sort of from end to end market transition, but. You know, it's a story that certainly in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s was very true. Whether it's still true today, you know, in this world of distributed innovation, whether the military, you know, is able to innovate faster than we see in open source communities, I mean, I think that's really an open question. But I think that there is, you know, historically some standing behind it. But, you know, anyway, it's all open on Twitter, back and forth. Take it there. I want to see all the details though, so I'll be taking all this either on a call if anybody wants to call in, I'm always interested in what Sandy has to say. So if she's not buying it, then you know there's probably something to that. I'm just scanning through other tweets. Oh, yeah, Solyndra question. Solyndra. I mean, Solyndra is not an early-stage investment. I mean, Solyndra was totally downstream. It's a much larger investment than I'm talking about. I mean, that's $500 million. SBIR grant starts at $100,000, and for a phase two, it's $750,000. So I mean, $100,000 is not $500 million. These are not the same kind of programs. And the notion that an investment in a company to get to scale – you know, for $500 million invalidate something like the SBIR program, that I don't buy. You know, one can take issue with the SBIR program. I spent 3 years on the National Academy of Sciences review panel of the SBIR. I've spent a lot of time looking at the outcomes from that program, and I personally am convinced that that's a very effective program. I know that, you know, Josh Lerner has a book, you know, talking about those of you that follow this kind of stuff, the government of venture capitalists, and, you know, it's called Boulevard of Broken Dreams. Josh is a brilliant guy. I totally disagree with him on the SBIR. I've got some blog posts on that, too. So, all right. So, bring it on the phones here. We got 8 minutes left. I got a couple of comments I want to make about the future, but yeah, as soon as I see, you're right, as soon as I see Sandy light up, I'm like running for cover, because Sandy will seriously take you down on Twitter. I mean, anybody who doesn't know that, you know, just watch out. And usually she's got, you know, a lot of insightful things to say. So, but I'm willing to take it on the phone, Sandy. Come on, let's go. No, she's not dialing in. Okay. That's cool. All right. Well, we got 7 minutes left. I'm going to take the last 5 minutes for anything else. And David, if you want to come talk about the I don't know if you're there, co-instructor David Miller, but we got a couple minutes to hear about your skepticism about early stage technology investments by the government. No? Okay. You know, I mean, part of this sort of story around around entrepreneurial opportunity is that whether it's government or comfortable incumbents, there's a lot of evidence of failure to adapt. And that creates opportunity for entrepreneurs. So the only thing I'm saying about, say, a company like GE, in particularly, say, medical devices, where they've been doing some really interesting stuff. Again, I went to visit IBM Almaden recently, and, I was talking to a guy named Jim Sporer out there. I mean, Jim is a very sharp guy, and these are companies with a lot of resources. And so so all incumbents are not the same. And in terms of your own projects, you don't want to you want to hitch your horse, you don't want to hitch your wagon to a horse that's already dying, but they're not all that way. So it complicates the narrative a little bit to say that there might be some incumbents that actually have developed internal processes to innovate. And it may be hugely stretching things to say that some of those entities might even include government entities. I'm not even sure I would go there. But I think in the business world, I'm at least open to the conjecture that some companies have developed an ability to do that. But it's not easy. There's no question about it. It is extremely difficult to innovate, to really innovate in a large company that has current customers to satisfy. All right, we've got five minutes left. So David's talking about picking winners. The whole notion that a program like the SBIR program is a picking winners program. I know that's not the point you're making. You're talking about Solyndra, but SBIR is a grants and contracts program. There's specifications laid out, and entrepreneurs respond, and that's the nature of the program. As far as downstream, I think the way to make a company like Solyndra successful is, again, to have very specific procurement requirements. Do it on the procurement side, not on the investment side. I don't think that there's any plausible motivation for the government to be supporting, to be providing low-cost loans or other types of subsidies to specific companies in the later stages. It should be providing a marketplace for the outputs of those companies. So I think that's the way in which the government can have an effective role. Because government's buying stuff anyway. And if the specifications are favoring old technologies and instead of favoring innovation, then that's a dimension for positive change. All right, 3 minutes left. We're going to keep the battle going. At least I will loop back in after we close our online class tonight, or our in-person class tonight. I want to mention three things. You're going to get a student survey. Everybody's going to get this. The online class, the in-person class, is going to get slightly different surveys, but anyway, you're going to get a survey in the next week. We need you to respond to the survey. We need to know where we are. Obviously, this whole course is an experiment, both the in-person and the online. This is something that I've never done, and these are approaches that few people have tried. We're trying to do something new. We need feedback. We can do some mid-course corrections. But we really need to know, what you guys think of where we've been so far. We've got great material coming up in the second half of the course. I think at least as strong as in the first half. We're going to be looping back with the whole group, everybody who signed up. They should not miss sessions like Fadi Handour coming up this Wednesday at 10 a.m. I'm going to really be pushing that on Twitter. Fadi is just a fantastic person and somebody who is hugely respected, not only in the countries where his company Aramex worked, but really throughout the entire Middle East and North Africa region. It's just a real honor that he's willing to spend an hour with us. So do not miss that either. Calling in at 10 a.m. Fadi's in Dubai, so that's why we're doing it at that time. 10 a.m. on Wednesday, Eastern Standard Time. Do not miss that. And then we'll go over the other. You can take a look online. We've got more great people coming up for the remainder of the course, and so in addition, I think to, you know, some further content clearly that I think is worthwhile. And most of all, and this is what I want to get to in the last 60 seconds, goals for completing the course. I mean, our objective when we started out was looking at other online courses of this type. We really would like to see 30% of the people who've signed up for this course complete all the requirements. And if we can get to 50%, we're going to be thrilled. 30% would be 150 people. So if you guys have hung with us, stick it out to the end. Let's complete the course. Let's get you an Ashoka U Online certificate. We're like about halfway. It's been a lot of work to get this point. And we want everybody who's on the call tonight, everybody who listens, to finish the course. And we want folks who have been tuned out to come back in, complete the requirements in 4 weeks, and get this done. We'd also like to see, out of the 150, 10 folks within the next 6 weeks post something to start some good. I think it would be fantastic if we could get 10% of the students, 15 people, to post something to start some good. So those are our two goals. Thanks for hanging with us. It's been a lot of fun from our end, and welcome further discussion on Twitter, positive and negative. You don't have to agree with what I'm saying, or whatever else is going on, but it's really about having an exchange. So great. Thanks again for joining us tonight, and we will be back. Okay, bye.